So we only have 15 seconds, but Andrea, I want to give you the last word. What then gives you hope?
I think that the future is a territory that we must defend. I said that the living alternatives, that the living solutions to the climate crisis already exist in indigenous communities that needs to be respected. I am also calling to the responsibility of the people around the world to stop consuming and exterminating indigenous territories and indigenous lands. We need to create solutions that are respectful with the life, with the planet, with ourselves, to think about a future where we do not need fossil fuels, but other green and renewable energies.
We have to leave it there, Andrea Ishu and Louis Wilson, thank you so much.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Did you miss the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/ACR to listen to the archived show. You can also snag a limited edition KBOO Afro-Caribbean and Reggae hoodie before November 20th to show your support for the music and the programming you love. Again, you can catch the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon and snag a limited edition hoodie at kboo.fm/ACR.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council considers where to spend its budget surplus, Oregon's redistricting map faces multiple court challenges, and a federal appeals court blocks President Biden's vaccine or test rule for many U.S. workers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 8th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, the Portland City Council will consider and potentially vote on where to spend its budget surplus. The City Council has an estimated $62 million in surplus funds it needs to distribute. It's common for the city to only see around $5 million in excess funds during this fall process. The spending increases are being funded by unexpectedly large city and county surpluses generated by high business license tax collections. Because of city policy, the council is only allowed to use half of these surplus dollars on city programs, while the rest is set aside for infrastructure costs. This leaves the council with about $31 million in one-time funds to spend on city programs. Last week, the city announced it would be setting aside nearly $19 million of those dollars for services and programs to address homelessness as part of a joint investment with Multnomah County. Mayor Ted Wheeler and Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori have proposed a spending plan that creates new homeless shelters, increases outreach teams, and cleans up trash generated at homeless encampments. Wheeler also proposed spending $7 million in city funds to immediately rehire 25 retired Portland police officers, increase their recruiting efforts to hire 200 more sworn officers, and also put the funds towards 100 unarmed safety specialists in the future, as well as expanding the Portland Street Response Program to citywide. Wheeler has said he has the support of enough city council members to pass his public safety proposals in a 3-2 vote. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has raised concerns about the proposal, including wanting more time and public input. Hardesty said she's open to rehiring retired police officers, but that her office will work on amendments to make sure the city does not bring back someone who left in lieu of a use of force investigation or who has complaints of discriminatory behavior. The city council will take public testimony and hear any amendments to the budget proposal on Wednesday, November 10th. The council could decide to vote on that same day. Otherwise, the budget goes into a second reading the following Wednesday. Lawsuits have been filed to challenge Oregon's congressional and legislative redistricting maps, but the suits likely face an uphill battle for overturning the results. KBOO's Laura Smith has more.
Oregon lawmakers may have finished redistricting, but legal challenges abound for the maps they've drawn, both at the congressional and state level. At the congressional level, where Oregon added one seat for a total of six in the U.S. House, Republicans accused the approved plan of being, quote, a clear, egregious partisan gerrymander. Norman Turrell with the League of Women Voters of Oregon says the state's redistricting rules have a set of criteria, such as using geographic barriers and not dividing communities of common interest. But he predicts it'll be tough to overturn maps based on these.
The criteria only say that they have to be considered, except for equal population. And the Supreme Court has previously said that it's enough that they have considered all the criteria, not necessarily followed any particular criteria.
A panel of judges has until November 24th to make a final decision in the case. At the legislative level, Lane County residents have filed a lawsuit in the Oregon Supreme Court with support from a Democratic legislator in the area. But Turrell believes that suit faces some of the same barriers to success as the congressional challenge. Another lawsuit filed at the end of October challenges, in part, the fact that hearing on legislative maps focused only on plans submitted by Democratic and Republican lawmakers. Turrell, who is also chair of the group People, Not Politicians, supports a constitutional amendment that could change this. Supporters are collecting signatures for an initiative to create a redistricting commission made up of citizens rather than legislators. Turrell believes citizens would do a better job.
The voters actually lose when the legislature gerrymanders the districts because the districts tend to be uncompetitive, and when they're uncompetitive, the voters can't change their representation and hold their elected officials accountable.
A handful of states have redistricting commissions made up of members who aren't politicians. In 2008, California voters approved a measure that created an independent commission comprised of 14 citizens. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, this is Laura Smith reporting.
A federal appeals court on Saturday temporarily blocked the Biden administration's workplace vaccine requirement. The White House announced Friday that an estimated 84 million private sector employees will be subject to a vaccine mandate to be completed by January 4th. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed a challenge along with leaders from Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Utah, and some private companies. The stay comes just days after the Biden administration announced new details about the vaccine mandate. The new emergency rule would apply to companies with greater than 100 employees and would be regulated through the Department of Labor. Similar to other vaccine mandates, the rule would require employees with medical or religious exemptions and those who otherwise choose not to get vaccinated to be masked in the workplace, and permits employers to pass the testing bill onto the individual employee. The rule is following a string of targeted state and private sector mandates that have been boosting local and industry-specific vaccination rates considerably. The announcement comes amid much resistance, as business groups report ongoing staffing concerns and regulatory barriers. The court stay, though, has little tangible impact at present, since the requirement is not slated to take effect until early January. Police have begun a criminal investigation into the deadly Astroworld Music Festival at NRG Park in Houston, Texas, after eight people were killed and many more injured. Rapper Travis Scott, who headlined and organized the festival, was due to perform shortly after 9 p.m. Friday when thousands of attendees rushed forward, getting closer to the stage. As Scott performed, the situation worsened and concertgoers near the front were trapped. Witnesses said people were being crushed or trampled as calls for help were drowned out by the music. It's unclear what Scott could see from the stage or how aware of the situation he was. Many, however, insist the music should have stopped immediately. A lawsuit has been filed by one concertgoer who was injured at the festival, named Manuel Souza, against Scott, as well as the entertainment group Live Nation, concert promoter Scoremore, and others that were involved in the event. Souza is being represented by the law firm Kirker Garcia, and they filed the suit in Harris County, Texas. According to the lawsuit, Souza, quote, suffered serious bodily injuries when the uncontrolled crowd at the concert knocked him to the ground and trampled him. Six people who were injured at the festival over the weekend are still in the hospital. Five of those remain in intensive care. A detailed operations plan for the music festival didn't include a specific contingency for a surging crowd incident, despite three people being trampled and hospitalized at the same festival in 2019. Police are investigating the potential causes of the incident. The organizers of Astroworld will provide a full refund to all ticket holders, both those who attended Friday and those who held tickets for Saturday's canceled events. According to a statement released Monday by a representative for the rapper, Scott will cover all funeral costs for the eight victims who died at the festival. Critics of a new public school proposal in St. Paul, Minnesota, say the proposal would hurt diverse communities. With more on the story, it's Favin Grezgeher with the Racial Reckoning Project.
A St. Paul Public Schools proposal that would close several schools is facing resistance from community members who say the plan leaves behind Black, Latinx, and immigrant families. At a board meeting earlier in October, school officials announced the proposal, called Envision SPPS, which would close, merge, or relocate 11 schools by next fall. Faced with 8,000 empty seats across the district, officials say they want to consolidate resources to ensure sustainable and well-rounded education programs. Opponents point out that most of the schools slated to close are in communities of color.
This is an issue of unequal balance of power. If you see the schools that are being slated for closure, they're chronically under-supported schools through SPPS.
Zaganesh Salam Ab says she chose Wellstone Elementary for its proximity and diversity and doesn't want to see it close.
They're really talking about taking a school that has a robust community and splitting it along language lines, like taking the Spanish-speaking kids and sending them to the west side, and then the English-speaking kids can get dispersed to other classes. It just feels like a very harsh splitting of a robust community that's integrated.
St. Paul Federation of Educators President Leah Van Dasser says the move is disruptive to students after an already difficult pandemic year.
Some of these places found out the day that the district announced it that the school was closing. I mean, this was a shock to a lot of people. There was a lot of harm done, and the district's just marching on like, oh, well.
Van Dasser says while the proposal is meant to address competition from charter schools, depending on how the school board votes on November 16th, families might end up leaving the district in the coming year. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Favin Garazgihad.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Ocean Blue Project's efforts to remove microplastics from Oregon beaches, followed by Noise Filter debunking myths about the COVID-19 pandemic. Stick around at 6, it's Labor Radio, then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 48 degrees. Tomorrow will also be rainy with a high of 56. Today in history, in 1895, physicist Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen becomes the first person to observe X-rays, a significant scientific advancement that would ultimately benefit a variety of fields. Today, X-ray technology is widely used in medicine, material analysis, and devices such as airport security scanners. The quote of the day is from American Baptist minister and leader of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "We have learned to fly the air like birds and swim the sea like fish, but we haven't learned the simple art of living together as brothers. Our abundance has brought us neither peace of mind nor serenity of spirit." House of Dreams is a local shelter that provides care for abandoned and homeless cats with the goal of finding them permanent homes. KBOO's Josh Salem spoke with House of Dreams representatives Melissa Slowski and Kristen Sparkland about the shelter and their upcoming fundraiser event, the Pretty Kitty Silent Auction.
The United States has an estimated 70 million stray or feral cats. They produce significant noise during fighting and mating and are associated with other problems like urine spraying to mark territory and predatory behavior. House of Dreams is a local all-volunteer shelter caring for abandoned and homeless cats. Today, I'm speaking with its representatives, Melissa Slavsky and Kristen Sparkland, to hear more about the shelter and an important annual fundraising event, the Pretty Kitty Silent Auction.
Thanks so much for joining me, Melissa and Kristen.
Of course.
Why don't you start by telling us a little about your roles in House of Dreams?
This is Kristen, and I have been a volunteer at House of Dreams for, well, since November of 1999, however long that makes it. I have, over the years, done just about everything. Kind of one of my main roles was I was on the board, and I was the board president for many years. And my other major role has been fundraising, and I'm also kind of a bank of institutional memory.
Hi, I'm Melissa, and I have been volunteering with House of Dreams for 4 or 5 years. I started out as somebody who just went in and did cleaning. I would go in and help out with just keeping areas clean for the cats, helping with socialization and just hanging out with the cats. And then I joined the team that does the silent auction for the Holiday Bazaar every year.
Great. Let's talk a little about your fundraising efforts. How important is fundraising in general to House of Dreams?
We don't have any like big institution behind us or any specific like wealthy individual or organization. We are almost entirely supported by our fundraisers and donations. And we really, you know, we really go far on like $5, $10, $20 donations. And then events like the upcoming silent auction are a huge part of our fundraising.
What can you tell us about your silent auction?
We've been doing it out of Tabor Space, which is where the Holiday Bazaar takes place every year, up until the start of COVID. So last year, for the very first time, we did it online. And I know we had no idea what to expect. I think last year was the most successful year for the silent auction. So I think the biggest thing is when we do it out of a space, we have actually very limited space. So online, we're able to have more items, which I think definitely makes a difference. We had a ton of different businesses and artists. We do get a lot of artists who donate as well. We have everything from case of wine, both red and white wine thrown in there. And then I know Missionary Chocolates donated. One of our volunteers, Leslie Cobb, she is an artist and she donates a lot of paintings every year. I know McMiniman's donated this year. Some of our cute items, we have something called a taco cat package. So there is a bed or a little area that looks like a taco truck. And cats can go in there and hang out. And there are lots of little fun things. I believe there's also a little avocado-shaped bed that goes along with it. So it's very cute. And some jewelry. Anyone who registers in order to bid, they're automatically entered into a drawing where they can win a quilt and a tote. And I have a raffle going, which is a 2 nights in historic Nye Beach. So we do have a bunch of different stuff, books, and we have a signed Mutz print, which we get every year. So it's a whole menagerie of things.
Can you go into a little more detail about how people actually access the site?
Yeah, so the easiest way to register for the silent auction, which starts on Tuesday, the 9th, is to go to the House of Dreams website, kittydreams.org. And on the very first page, on the landing page or homepage, there's a link to another page that'll take you to the registration page.
I do want to thank you so much for being our guest today, and I hope House of Dreams has a very successful auction.
Appreciate it.
We just heard from Melissa Slavsky and Kristen Sparkland, who work with the House of Dreams Cat Shelter. Their Pretty Kitty virtual silent auction takes place from Tuesday, November 9th through Sunday, November 14th. For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Josh Salem.
President Joe Biden praises the House passage of his first infrastructure bill. Steele dossier analyst Igor Deshenko is arrested, and an appeals court temporarily halts Biden's vaccine mandate. With more on those stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Jobs, making high-speed internet affordable and available everywhere in America.
Over the weekend, President Joe Biden touted one of the benefits of his $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill after the measure passed the House late Friday. The president described the bill as a once-in-a-generation investment that would put the U.S. on a path to win the economic competition of the 21st century. Biden said he planned to sign the bill soon, but National Journal congressional reporter Casey Wooten says Biden has a ways to go on his larger social program and climate package.
This infrastructure bill is on its way to the president. President's desk. But Build Back Better, you know, it's far from being done here.
Former President Donald Trump has sharply criticized Senate Republicans and their leader, Mitch McConnell, for allowing passage of the bipartisan infrastructure bill. A Russian analyst who worked on the Steele dossier has been arrested in the U.S. The controversial document accused Trump of being linked to the Kremlin and colluding with Russia to win the 2016 election. But the Department of Justice has charged Igor Deshenko with lying to the FBI. Former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State Colin Powell was honored at a National Cathedral funeral service Friday. Madeleine Albright, herself Secretary of State under Clinton, remembered her colleague.
He and I were shaped by different experiences and had different ideas and represented different departments. But over the past quarter century, we also became very close friends.
Saturday, an appeals court temporarily blocked President Biden's coronavirus vaccine mandate for businesses with 100 employees or more. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed the challenge, but was joined by states including Louisiana, Mississippi, Utah, and South Carolina. In Las Vegas, at the Republican Jewish Coalition's annual leadership meeting, former Vice President Mike Pence took aim at President Biden's policies toward Israel.
He restored funding to the Palestinian Authority. He announced his intention to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. And now the Biden administration is planning to open a consulate in Jerusalem for the Palestinian people.
On Friday, opening arguments began in the trial of three white men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man in Georgia. The 12-person jury includes 11 white people and one black person, a racial makeup that Superior Court Judge Timothy Walmsley said might have been, quote, intentional discrimination on the part of defense attorneys. Thousands gathered in Glasgow, Scotland Saturday to protest a lack of global action to combat climate change. The United Nations COP26 summit, slated to last another week, has drawn more than 100 world leaders. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Flags were raised across Canada after talks with Native leaders, and new bills aim to complete the White Mountain Apache Water Project. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Flags on Canadian government buildings across the country are flying at full mast for the first time in nearly 6 months. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the flags were raised after talks with Indigenous leaders.
The flags were first lowered to honor the Native children who died and suffered at residential schools. That came after the remains of hundreds of Indigenous children were found at the sites of two of the former schools, one in British Columbia, the other in Saskatchewan. Raising the flags ahead of Remembrance Day has become a controversial issue. After talks with Native groups, the flags will be hoisted so they can be again lowered on Remembrance Day to honor those Canadians who died in wars. Mark Miller is the Crown Indigenous Relations Minister.
What we've heard loud and clear from all involved is that this is a responsibility of the federal government and not to put it on the, on the backs of Indigenous peoples who are already going through a lot these days. But there were a different and varying ranges of perspectives, some ranging from leave the flags down until everything is found and in the light of day and children returned home to their communities, and others saying that it was time now to lift them. But what we heard resoundingly in that, I mean, no one expected a consensus, was that this was a responsibility of the federal government to take a decision.
The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Roseanne Archibald, had wanted the government to raise an orange Every Child Matters flag alongside the Canadian flag until, as she put it, all of our children are recovered, named, and physically or symbolically returned to their homelands. The plan now includes lowering the Canadian flags to half-mast every year on September the 30th, the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. Ottawa says it's also working to find a suitable place to raise the survivor's flag. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Bills recently introduced in Congress aim to complete a long-awaited drinking water project for the White Mountain Apache tribe in Arizona. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the reservation has lacked a dependable water supply for years.
The legislation would amend a federal water rights settlement with the White Mountain Apache tribe that was enacted by Congress in 2010. It would extend the timeline for the large-scale infrastructure project by 2 years and increase its funding from $11 million to $261 million. Cost overruns and unforeseen technical delays in the planning and design phases have hampered the White Mountain Apache Rural Water System and Minor Flat Dam. Tribal leaders say it's desperately needed to provide members with a clean and reliable source of drinking water that many communities on the Fort Apache Indian Reservation lack. According to officials, that's led to increases in public health risks, including COVID-19. The tribe had one of Arizona's highest rates of infection during the 2020 summer surge. The White Mountain Apache tribe is made up of about 13,500 people on the reservation located in eastern Arizona's White Mountains. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Air is Life Act is signed into law on the Navajo Nation to promote a smoke-free tribe. President Jonathan Nez signed the bill into law on Saturday. It prohibits commercial tobacco use, such as cigarettes, e-cigarettes, and smokeless tobacco products in enclosed and indoor workplaces and public areas on the reservation. The law does not restrict use in private residences or for ceremonial or cultural purposes. For more than a decade, advocates with the Air is Life Coalition have worked on public education and collaborated on the bill. The infrastructure package sent to President Biden includes resources for tribal communities, funding for federal programs in Native communities to address water and sanitation, transportation, broadband, energy, water settlements, mine and well cleanup, and other investments. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 8th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Margot Reed, Josh Salem, Laura Smith, and Ethan Sandweiss. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Faven Gerezgiher, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, tune in for Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Times Like Now with Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means, hosted by Joseph Gallivan. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on removing microplastics from Oregon beaches.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
So, Richard Arterberry, we talked last time in April. You are one of the co-founders of the Ocean Blue Project, which is an Oregon-based national nonprofit working to save the ocean from removing microplastics. It's a pleasure to have you here and back on KBOO.
Thank you.
So could you kind of summarize what are some of the problems that microplastics cause? I feel like we hear a lot about them, but sometimes it's hard to grasp the specifics of the issue.
Totally, yeah. Microplastic is anywhere from like 5 millimeters to, you know, all the way down to 1 millimeter. The main setback or the problem that I'm seeing is if we overlook it and we continue stepping on it, it gets smaller and smaller. It never truly goes away, but it gets so small that you actually can't recover it any longer. And it ends up in the ocean and ends up in our waterways. And the biggest sad part about it is our fish are eating it and other animals that we eat. So as, you know, they eat it and we eat them, I mean, it's getting into humans as well and just causing who knows what kind of issues. And it actually kills wildlife. A lot of the birds, they love the red plastic. I don't know if they think it's food or some sort, but they eat it until they consume it. Their bellies are completely full and they suffer, they die, and they don't know any better. You know, they're just out there having fun eating things.
So you've been doing cleanup projects for how long now?
9 years ago, my son and I founded Ocean Blue Project, and he was 12 years old or 9 years old at the time, and we just did one beach cleanup, and it was kind of overwhelming at a sense of how much our group had recovered. So we kind of just thought, hey, let's just do it on the weekends as a hobby. And then a lot of college students wanted to do cleanups as well, and it just kind of, it never ended.